Adrian, I am Olga Barnosi, Managing Director of Capital Inc. Welcome to the Capital Inc. Invest in Greece webinar series. Today's webinar, the fifth in the series, will focus on the Greek banking sector, its development, outlook, growth opportunities and challenges, and its role in the growth of the Greek economy. We have with us the Chief Financial Officers of the four systemic banks. The roundtable discussion will be moderated by Eleni Ismailou, Senior Analyst at Axia Ventures Group. Eleni will introduce the panelists. Before turning the floor to her, just two quick remarks. First, a reminder of the usual disclaimer that our webinars are strictly for informational and educational purposes. Second, in terms of logistics, webinar participants can submit questions through the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen. Time permitting, the questions will be addressed after the discussion. I would like to thank our panelists, the moderator, and all of you for joining our webinar today. Eleni, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Olga, and hi all from my side. I would like to extend a warm welcome to our participants from my side and present our panelists. Today with us we have Lazaros Papagaryfallou, Alpha Bank CFO, Haris Kokologiannis, Eurobank CFO, Christos Christodoulou, NBG CFO, and Theo Gnardellis, Piraeus Bank CFO. Gentlemen, welcome to the panel. As in previous Capital Links webinars, other speakers have discussed and covered most aspects around Greece's macro story and the background, including some high-level highlights around the banking sector. I suggest to cut to the chase, if you all agree with me. That said, my first question would be around loans and margins. And Theo, I would like to turn to you for the first question. So loan growth in Greece has been trending at mid-single digit rates despite the supportive macro environment and the low level of leverage in the economy. On the other hand, we have more than 70 billion of legacy loans sitting in the hands of the NPE servicers. What are the preconditions to return a portion of these loans to the banking system? How big is this envelope and when should we expect this to materialize? And I would like to add a second leg to this question, addressing the competition on lending spreads. Could you please provide some insights into how lending spreads are evolving and the impact of market competition? Hey. Theo, the floor is yours.
All right. So loans. Look, the loans have been growing in Greece. As you said, it has been a mild growth overall, substantial one if you look at it simply from the business segment. I would say retail is a victim of the massive growth of the past, right? We're now repaying on mortgages. We're seeing repayments, substantial repayments from the older vintages, the pre-2010, and as a result, has been kind of static. That said, the production of mortgages on a gross basis has been increasing, especially after some government initiatives took place last year. We see the results this year and more to discuss over the coming months. But rightly pointed out, what has gone into the servicers for management is a substantial number, right? In many ways, it is comparable in size with the overall PE exposure of the market. We've got about 50 billion right now, I think, in HAPS, and something under 20 billion in other transactions overall managed by servicers. The important one thing we need to understand is that obviously these are riskier assets, right? So it's and it's important that the ones that make it back to the banks, and eventually we will discuss how and they will, do not increase the risk profile of the performing exposures. I think an estimate, a fair estimate right now would be that, you know, if out of the 70 billion and as per servicer plans, half of them will follow the restructuring approach and under a haircut of 30-40%, you're probably looking at something between 15 to 20 billion eventual exposures that could make it back to banks. But something we need to understand that this is not automatic, right? This will not happen immediately, primarily because the servicer approach is a cash-driven approach, right? It's not an EBA-driven approach. So typically restructurings of servicers Because of the difficult situation that the border might be in, et cetera, you know, you might have step ups or you might have bullets or you might have things that make the loan difficult, if not impossible, to be immediately classified as stage one. That said, what needs to happen and what will inevitably happen is that that criteria, these EBA guidelines that a loan needs to follow to be stage one classified, and overall to make sure that the risk profile of these reperforming loans are at par with what we have right now in the performing exposures, that is a collaboration that will start happening and needs to happen between banks and servicers, so that servicers can incubate and generate loans that are indeed migratable to banks. And you know, further to the regulatory restrictions that one might think about, the primary goal is this. We of course, we want to repatriate those loans. Of course, this is an important thing, but it needs to happen in a way that the expected credit loss of the books stay at par. We're enjoying very low cost of risk right now, which enable us to, and we will discuss now to your second leg, which enable us to, you know, marginally reduce spreads in a profitable manner. And we cannot go back to the situation. We cannot go back to a redefault circle that puts question marks onto the asset quality of banking balance sheets. With the discussion with supervisors, of course, needs to happen for this because they are also in the same boat to make sure that that the risk profile of the balance sheet stay at the very good level that we are today. And to make it clear, nobody has the upper hand here in terms of banks that have not securitized loans versus banks that have securitized loans, et cetera. It's a misconception that I think it's a good opportunity to take it out of the way. There is no formalistic approach here. What everybody will do is the work to make sure that there's enough data, enough payment history, enough border profiling to ensure banks that what they're bringing back is at par with their overall risk profile. So the answer is probably 15 to 20 billion. The answer is there is not simply a passage of time. Clearly, there's some incubation time that needs to happen, but there's also a job to be done over the coming years. We have an opportunity that servicers can do the deeper cuts that are needed for restructurings for them to become sustainable stage one loans. And I think, you know, now that we have landed in a more kind of comfortable situation in terms of capital profitability and liquidity and overall macro environment, the work will accelerate over the coming years. And you had a second leg about spreads, right?
Correct. If you could provide some insights on how lending spreads are evolving, I mean, and the impact of the market competition, of course.
Competition is there, and it needs to be there, and it's rightfully there, and will stay there. What is interesting and very, very promising is that the spread erosion that we have seen is somewhat contained. Of course, there is the odd deal that, you know, people are looking for the marquee deal, you know, for the headline, et cetera, and one deal here, one deal there. You know, I would say all banks, and also depending on the risk appetite, their knowledge of a particular industry, you know, there might be more present in one deal versus the rest. But overall, we're looking at a systemic behavior that is rational. In what sense? The spread erosion is following the overall risk profile of the loan in terms of expected credit loss and the overall cost of capital, right? So spreads will drop, but they will drop to the extent that, you know, they can create a substantial revenue pool for banks to be able to return capital to shareholders. And I think that education that the Greek banks have gone through is one of the legacy benefits of the past, right? I mean, people now, it seems like we are avoiding the obvious dilemma of, you know, let's just get some extra spread versus risk-free because, you know, I believe that nothing will happen. We're not into the qualitative lending method at all. I would say the Greek banking sector is one of the more educated and kind of well-versed in assessing, measuring risk. It's a learning that that was very it was very hard to develop over the past years, but it's one of those, I would say, legacies that have stayed with us and are helping us in this new phase.
Thank you, Theo, very much for your answers. I would like to stay on the subject of margins, but move on to profitability a bit. As we already witnessed that the Greek banking sector has benefited significantly from the high rates environment. And Lazare, I would like to turn over to you now, because with the downward part of the interest rate cycle upon us, I would like your view on how do you expect NII to evolve from here, and what are the mechanisms that you have put in place to protect the NII generation over the next couple of years, let's say our investment horizon, together with your hedging strategy.
Thank you, Eleni. Good afternoon to everyone. Trying to assess the impact of rates on the financial sector, I think we should also take into consideration overall macro factors. Assuming that the landing rate is a 2 to 2.5% neutral rate for an economy that had just got out of the woods and expected to grow nominally at circa 4 to 5% in the medium terms, I think that in all context creates a positive momentum for credit demand, cost of risk, and other banking activities. So overall, I think that the sector will see some modest pressure in the near term at varying levels between the various banks. But in the end, the positive medium-term dynamics will reemerge for all of us. Looking at the short-term trends, I think it is clear that the net interest income has reached its local peak. Getting to the discussion of the near-term evolution, it's obvious that we do see the deposit beta going up, albeit at a lower pace compared to what we have initially projected. And it is also obvious that there is an increasing cost for hedging our core deposits, and this is reflected in the hedging policies. And since you have alluded to the impact of hedging, I want to create some context behind this topic. I remind that we started the hiking cycle with almost 90% of loans in floating rates, and all the banks have a diversified granular deposit base. So the combination of these two is a recipe for increased profitability in a high rate environment. Natural hedging on the commercial side has been relatively low at the beginning. Since early 2023, we have started reducing our interest rate sensitivity by increasing our natural fixed rate assets, putting loans and bonds in the balance sheet. Later on, we have started adding fixed rate receivers against our core deposits, and we have also hedged our own debt. So as a result of these combined actions, we have seen the ratio of fixed rate assets to fixed rate liabilities to go up from a low 40% to 75% as things stand. Will we add more? It depends on balance sheet developments as well as on macro trends and the evolution of rates, which is an unknown, a question mark. So we need to retain some flexibility around that. What's next? What will happen going forward? I think that to some extent, we will see the cost of deposits going higher as people move their deposits to time. deposits and the stock reprices upwards. As I said, the conversion so far has been relatively low, progressing slower than expected, but we also see some movements towards assets under management. And the latter may be negative short term for the interest rate, net interest income. But on the other hand, it creates a sustainable asset light income that will prove to be more important when rates go lower. As far as Alpha is concerned, year to date, we have added 2.5 billion in AUMs, capturing almost 30% of that flow. And this is a conscious strategy to increase asset light income. Moreover, we were going to see loans repricing lower. We have already started seeing that as per sectoral data published by Bank of Greece. There is a repricing lag of 4 months. So the pressure will be there on the loan side. Time deposits take longer to reprice. There is an average maturity of 7 months or so. So the benefits will be more visible in 2025. Higher for longer means that some pockets of demand stay muted or lower than what we initially anticipated. And there is also some pressure on credit spreads, where what we're trying to do with our corporate customers is to offer a fixed rate product for them through derivatives and locking the historical spread that we have in the relationship. On top of these trends, which are more or less sectoral, there are certain idiosyncratic drivers for the players in the system. We have different positions in excess liquidity, and we have seen the impact of that in 2023 in the hiking cycle. And the opposite will, to some extent, happen on the way down. As far as securities are concerned, again, there we may have some differences among the players on the levels that we can add or on the investment profile of our portfolio. We, as Alpha Bank, as I said, added securities in 2023 in a more meaningful way. We're adding in 2024 an additional 2 billion or 12% increase. And we have also ahead of us a couple of quarters for investments of at least 1% higher yield in spite of the fall of market rates. To conclude, Eleni, if someone looks through the short-term dynamics, I think that the medium-term prospects are positive. And we do have tangible drivers to support the top line.
Excellent, Lazare, thank you very much. I would like to stay with you a bit and move to net fee and commission income. So earlier this year, along with your business plan announcements, there was a highlight of strategic focus on growing fee contributions to revenue growth. Could you tell us a bit more about what business lines do you see the biggest opportunities in and what drivers could facilitate this growth?
Indeed, fees and commissions are an important driver in our plan. I think starting to answer your question, I want to frame it referring to the drivers and the structural trends in the system that support fee growth. To start with, we have a solid macro backdrop. And this is the backbone of increased activity, either in transaction volumes, in loan disbursements, in the growth of financial assets. But you have also some structural trends in the market. We see increasing financial literacy in the population with various parts of the population becoming more knowledgeable, trying to hold the right financial assets for their profile. I remind that during the Greek sovereign crisis, the state's role has been overhauled as far as the provision of health and pension services are concerned, with people turning towards the private sector solutions. We have seen legislation passed by the government incorporating a framework for corporate pension plans or promoting property insurance through tax breaks. It's the bank structure, which is less fragmented than in the past, and more liquid, reducing the relative attractiveness of saving products. You have digitization, downstreaming wealth products into underpenetrated segments. You have climate change, increasing the frequency of extreme events and creating that demand, especially in the southern Mediterranean countries, for insurance coverage. I remind that in Greece, home ownership is high at 75%, but only 15% of homes are insured. We have a significant shift of monetary transactions to the digital channels, and many other structural changes that are conducive for demand of projects and services that can bring ancillary income to the bank. Answering the question, what is the relevant population we're targeting for those products and services? To some extent, the answer is everyone, because as the economic activity picks up, so will transactions, and that is relevant for everyone. In some other product lines, the profiles of the client are more important, and in earnest, as far as affluent and emerging affluent customers are concerned, we think that those segments will drive growth on the individual side, and some more sophisticated corporates and SMEs, and all these client segments are in the DNA of the bank, and that's why we have focused so much on growing those segments and products targeted to those segments. Another topic to focus on is how we're doing that, better positioning ourselves for this growth opportunity. And I will start with our asset management product factory, which is doing very well, retaining the group in the first position in the non-money market funds space with good quality products. We do have an open architecture model, promoting also the products of third parties. And that's where the agreement with UniCredit will help us promote additional products, bringing the One Market Funds to our clients within 2024. We're also working with UniCredit to promote unit-linked funds, where they have a very good position in the Italian market. Our ecosystem of partners includes also Generali, with whom we are working to develop some new innovative products. And we do see a good growth in production by 30% or more. We have recently launched some innovative products digitally in cybersecurity, protection, or patient health. So there is scope for new products in the market. And we are working with ecosystem of partners to be present. Also, the way we conduct business with our clients is changing. We are revamping our retail operating model, introducing relationship managers for the emerging affluent clients. The condition precedent to do so is to ensure that we have the digital banking capabilities to adhere to their demands and expand the digital product palette. through also offering an omni-channel experience for our customers.
Excellent. Thank you, Lazare, very much for your insights. And now, speaking of omnichannel experiences, I would like to turn back to Theo, because today the European banking landscape is becoming more competitive than ever. Theo, how do you perceive the current digital banking landscape, and what significant changes have you observed in the recent years? I mean, with the rise of digital banking and the decline in traditional bank branches, how are the Greek banks adapting to the shift? And again, you know me well now, I would like to add a second leg to this question, because in an era where customers expect nothing less than seamless, personalized and secure interactions, the spotlight on customer experience has intensified for all financial institutions. So my question here would be, in what ways are the Greek banks utilizing digital transformation to enhance this customer experience? And if you could share any examples of how personalization and omnichannel banking are being implemented to create this experience for customers.
Right. Okay, so digitization, you know, it means a lot of things, and it has been used multiply in various circumstances. I would say primarily in the context of efficiency rather than, you know, the context of the question you're asking. I mean, obviously banks have, especially systemic banks, kind of traditional banks, we've run down the bricks and mortar channels. There has been substantial reduction of branches. I would say normalizing the footprints pretty much to the micro market size that that the Greek landscape prescribes. In some of the countries, we saw kind of deeper declines. In others, we saw milder declines. Depends a lot on the branch models. So that's one clear effect, was that the rundown of or the rationalization, I would say, of the footprint. The second one was the step up, the substantial increase of digital investments. Banks are now spending, Greek banks were tech-starved for a long period, that's true. But in the last few years, and judging from Piraeus Bank, the expenditure on digital has increased by a massive amount. In our case, it's more than 70%. So, you know, a lot of money is thrown into technology right now, enabling the digital channels, enabling automations on the background. But so that was the obvious, I would say, reaction. One thing that is interestingly happening recently is that we're changing branch models, right? So we're not abandoning, I would say, bricks and mortar. We're changing the bricks and mortar to create what you described as an omnichannel experience. And that's important because high street presence is not obsolete, right? High street presence is here to stay. We're actually seeing traditional sectors going into high street, making acquisitions to establish points of sales in high street. And it's not simply a point of sale. It's a high street presence prescribes confidence to banking customers. And it's important. And it's the reason why the liquidity primarily stays with strong high street presence banks, rather than, you know, seeing the what people were discussing a few years or decades ago about fintech. And liquidity is with bricks and mortar, and that's an output of the trust that it brings. That said, the branch models have changed. We're stepping up the penetration of roles that are facing customers. We're taking away roles that you know are more kind of back office operational, so that helps with efficiency and effectiveness, and that's an interesting turn. But we still have, I would say, also looking at other examples, work in front of us. The omnichannel experience that you have discussed, you know, we do have a couple of examples. One would be that, yes, now you can apply for a loan digitally, and that application can be picked up at the branch, and you can inquire about it at the call center. So that kind of omnichannel experience is there. It exists. Digital onboarding was a very big thing where people can now become customers of the banks and open accounts, supported also by some good initiatives that were digitization initiatives that were done by the government to enable KYC process and be able to digitally authenticate people. You know, we do have this good use cases and kind of war stories, but there's a lot of work in front of us to take care of exception handling, for example, if something goes wrong in this kind of happy path. We all have kind of the cynical war story to talk about, and the banks will be addressing those. AI will play a big part in that, in using AI beyond the obvious use cases to solve and kind of, I would say, either black box or put makeup in a lot of the bureaucracy that the banks need to come with. And it's an ongoing journey. It will take time and money, but it's not has not happened in other jurisdictions. There are some very good examples that we will all study and follow.
Lovely. Thank you, Theo, very much. And actually, you set the floor very nicely for the next question, which is a little bit about costs here. And I'd like to turn to Christos now for these questions. So, Christos, as we discussed with Theo, with the Greek banks now fully embracing the digitalization, we've seen increased investments in IT and some staff costs rising due to the variable pay that there is in place. Are we at a point where costs will begin to flatten or have a small uptick going forward? How will these investments help you outperform targets and translate into revenue eventually, in your view?
Hi, Eleni, and good afternoon to everyone from myself. So first, let me thank the Capital Link team for the invitation as well as for organizing this this very nice event. And now to your question. I think what Theodoris explained was very interesting, but let me start from what the Greek banks have achieved in the past years. And I think we've achieved a great deal with regards to managing our costs, mostly through branch closures, I would say, accompanied, of course, by numerous and sizable voluntary exit schemes. Especially here at NBG, we've managed to reduce FTEs and branches in Greece by around 40%, I would say, since the peak, and we are now enjoying a cost-to-income ratio of about 30%. I think the system as a whole is operating with very efficient cost-to-income ratios, which it is testament to what we've achieved on our OPEX base. Of course, supported by the increased income that we are enjoying on the back of the increasing interest rates as well. Now, I would say that there is still some opportunity for optimization. I wouldn't say in further branch closures, but more in how much people we operate the branches with, where we believe that we can be a bit more efficient. So initiatives to further optimize costs are there. I think we've created a culture where we are very, I would say, strict or more optimal in the way that we demand and we expense for our everyday activities. And this hopefully will be sustained in the future. Now, having said that, this cost reduction also needs to be done sensibly and timely in order to avoid operational disruption as well as comfort, discomfort for the customers. So while cost discipline is important, we do also prioritize as banks for customer experience. Now, given this in NBG, we have accompanied our cost-cutting efforts with concurrent initiatives for processes automation as well as digitization. So as a result, we took a strategic decision years ago to invest significantly in our IT infrastructure, I would say starting as early as 2019. And we have since changed almost all our IT peripheral systems. And most importantly, we are currently replacing our core banking system, which we hope to complete in the next, 18 months or so. This will improve our operational efficiency. It will provide greater flexibility in terms of product creation. It will also set stronger defenses against cyber risk. And of course, all of this will also improve overall customer experience. Providing seamless banking is one of the key initiatives and tactics that we have in our bank. Now, you've also mentioned the variable pay and staff costs. Without the right people, there is not much you can do, I would say. But people have been the core enabler of our successful transformation so far, and will be key for achieving our targets in the future. I believe investing in human capital is imperative given what we've learned so far. Now, to improve going forward, you need to invest in talent retention as well as to attract the right skill sets. Tools like variable pay and, in general, rewarding performance are very useful to facilitate this effort. We have been very cautious with regards to managing our staff costs in the sense of rewarding our people, and it's one of our top priorities for the next years as well. So all in all, I would say, given all the things mentioned above, as well as being mindful of the inflation levels in the real economy, we at MBG are guiding for a low single-digit increase in costs over the next 2 to 3 years. I think the message here is that we need to have the right balance between cost optimization, but at the same time, targeted investments so as to sustainably raise our game going forward. Expectation for the bank is not just to deliver on numbers, but also to be there for the customer base and to be able to provide better services and better products for the future. I think that goes in hand with what Thodoris mentioned about us being able to appreciate what technology has to offer, not only doing what is expected, but also being pioneers in the way that we embrace the technological advances in the future.
Lovely. Thank you, Christo, very much for your comments and insights. Over to Harris now to talk about asset quality a bit, which I think it's the new sweet spot of the Greek banking sector, as we've seen a continuous improvement in the NPE ratio during the period of elevated interest rates. So, Harris, reflecting on this, what factors contributed to this improvement in your view? And since we all anticipate that the ratio will keep decreasing in the outer periods, is there any area that poses a higher risk to this outlook?
Hi, Elena, and good afternoon to everyone. It is true that asset quality has remained resilient during the last years. We have faced a number of headwinds that could cause damage to our asset quality of Greek banks, indicatively the high interest rates, inflation, geopolitical tensions in our neighborhood. However, we cannot ignore a number of idiosyncratic factors that kept asset quality in very satisfactory levels. Idiosyncratic, I mean country-related. The first is the strong growth of the Greek economy. Last year, we grew with 2%, while the medium term for the next couple or 3 years, the projections point to a growth of 2.5%, overperforming respective growth in the euro area significantly. The surplus liquidity that was created in the last 3-4 years has led to an increase, significant increase of deposit, and actually was one more weapon to face the challenges of the macro. The continuing decrease of unemployment at levels historically low, close to 10%, whereby the real unemployment is substantially lower. The real estate prices have shown a remarkable resilience in the last years, and an initiative that was adopted from the Greek systemic banks since May 2023 to put a cap on interest rates charged to the floating mortgages. All this actually have created a protection that prevented asset quality deterioration. In this context, we should know that all Greek banks now have reduced their NPE ratios to low single-digit levels and are moving in a consistent way towards European average levels. As Eurobank is concerned, we have reached the a 3% NPE ratio in the first quarter of 2024, and we expect to move to hover around this ratio for the rest of the year. Having said that, and having considered all these positive factors, as the Eurobank, we have taken a countercyclical approach as regards cost of risk and coverage. We have, in the first quarter, we had a record coverage of 93%. And in cost of risk, despite the fact that formation is moving at levels lower than the full year outlook that we had in our budget, we had a cost of risk in of 68 basis points in the first quarter. For the full year, the outlook that we had provided to analysts and investors was for a cost of risk of close to 80 basis points. It appears that considering the formation and the general climate, we are going to be well below that. I would say close to 70 basis points. Now, as regards your question about the most vulnerable sectors in the economy, certainly these mortgage loans, as higher for longer interest rates may have an impact on the disposable income of households. So far, and also assisted from the cap that we have implemented in mortgage loans, we haven't seen any material deterioration in the default rates of mortgage loans.
Excellent. Thank you, Harry, very much. And finally, let's talk about capital and shareholders' reward, which is increasingly my favorite topic. Because June marked a milestone for the Greek banking sector with the regulator approving dividend distributions after many years. So in terms of outlook, my question here would be beyond this, and as we continue to generate high levels of organic capital and as payout ratios are expected to rise to 50% by 2025, what other capital deployment strategies are you considering? And will the focus be more on organic or inorganic growth? And I think Lazarus could start by sharing Alpha's view here. Then maybe Christos can share his thoughts, followed by Harris, who could give us Eurobank's view. Gentlemen, the floor is yours.
Yeah, Eleni, indeed, the first approval after many years of dividends by the regulator is a major milestone for the system. I think everyone in the panel will agree with me that we are all very, very glad to reinstate shareholder remuneration. It's a strong signaling effect. Same goes with the return to investment grade for the banks, which sends additional positive signals. Now, coming to capital allocation and the agendas of the various players, you know, from the outside, it may seem that we have different strategies, but I think all of us share the same motivation to allocate capital in a way that maximizes shareholder value. And referring to Alpha, we do have a strong organic capital generation supported by profits, and we continue to optimize the capital structure and the balance sheet. And that comes on top of the existing strong capital buffers that enable the delivery of a healthy level of distributions going forward. You may have seen from 2023 numbers that we're proposing a combination of a cash dividend and a buyback. We want to ensure that we have a track record, and we build that record for cash dividends, with a yield that approaches the European levels in the next couple of years. But we are also cognizant of the returns that the buyback can procure, given where our stock is trading. And if we look at the investment horizon of the plan, we do portray distributions that amount to 30% of our existing market cap and still have excess equity capital at the end of the period, another 40% of the market cap, which suggests that there is potential scope to do more. Now, what we will do Depends on obviously the available opportunities out there and the IRRs of those opportunities that they can produce. That may include buybacks if the supervisory approval is there. It may include reperforming loans as the market progresses. And we have these data points from services that Theodore referred to. And having healthy capital buffers, we can also assess inorganic opportunities in Greece and abroad. It goes without saying that any action needs to further enhance the shareholder value and align with our strategy objectives. Our success or failure will be just judged upon these one elements. And I think that, you know, as a final note, I mentioned that we are well past the age of empires.
Okay, thank you, Lazare, very much. Christo, over to you now.
It's hard not to repeat after what Lazare described, but let me try and differentiate a bit. So first of all, I think what has to be said about capital, given the levels we enjoy at the moment, as well as the fact that we've opened, let's say, the door, the long-awaited door on the distribution to shareholders, is still to maintain, you know, our mission to support credit expansion and organic growth in Greece. So that remains priority, I think, for all the banks. Now, having said that, given the level of growth that we see in Greece and given the levels of liquidity and capital we have to explore more opportunities. I think what Theo, you know, talked about at the beginning is very important. Although I would think none of us has anything baked in the business plan for the next 3 years at least, this NP ecosystem, as we call it, is a great opportunity for the banks. I mean, you assign a number to the number of loans that will be taken back, let's say, in the banking sector going forward. Given that the GDP of Greece is around 220 billion, it's still a very substantial amount. So I would say that part of the excess capital should be not set aside, but we need to consider that opportunity of the reperforming NPs when they are mature enough, well cured, and the regulator is very comfortable with us tapping, let's say, that opportunity in the market. Now, there's also opportunities abroad with regards to assets, let's say. In our case, we are always considering the syndication market abroad, especially in areas, in sectors where we consider ourselves experts. I would add to these kind of sectors like project finance, energy projects, shipping. In those cases, we can consider participating in syndications. And why not, maybe in some cases, even originate loans in jurisdictions that are closer to us in terms of culture, or where Greek corporates operate and can help them grow their organizations outside Greece. I would also make reference to what Lazaro said about opportunities for inorganic growth, M&A opportunities. We need to be very careful when we deploy capital in that direction. I agree that if it's not a deal that adds value for the shareholders, if we cannot prove synergies in exploring any endeavors in that direction, we need to be very careful not to destroy capital in that effort to create and utilize capital efficiently. And I think lastly, what's the most important thing is shareholders' remuneration. We do believe in, you know, slowly increasing the payouts to shareholders. Buybacks is something very interesting, as Lazarus mentioned. It could make a lot of sense for us to invest in our own stock, especially with where we are trading at the moment, or in comparison with the cost of equity that we currently assign. So that's I think it's still a great opportunity for us. So I would say it's a nice problem to have this capital positions we enjoy, and we need to be very careful on the options that we make in the future to deploy in a value-adding manner that excess capital.
Excellent. Thank you, Christo, very much. And Harry, over to you now.
Thank you for this for this question. First of all, let's be conscious of the discussion that we are doing now. We are talking about surplus capital in Greek banks. It is something that some years ago was might be an anecdote, so a joke. So we are in a happy position to discuss about dividends and how to deploy surplus capital. As Eurobank, we have presented in our business plan that throughout the three-year business plan horizon, we are going to have, despite the increasing dividend payout, surplus capital between 250 to 300 basis points. And as we have said, the priorities to deploy capital are threefold. First, it's loan organic growth, and in this context, the first half of the year was very strong, both in Greece as well as in Bulgaria and Cyprus. Second, M&A opportunities, and in this context, we have provided evidence in the last years that we have increased our footprint in the core countries that we operate, namely Greece, Bulgaria, and Cyprus. In Cyprus, we have increased our stake to Hellenic Bank at 55.3%, and currently we run a mandatory tender offer. In Bulgaria, we have acquired, we have made a number of acquisitions in the last 3 years. The last one was the acquisition of BNP, the consumer finance, the personal finance arm of BNP. A part of these countries where we continue to be vigilant for any opportunities that make economic sense, we are examining a number of monoline business expansion in terms of monoline business in some new jurisdiction in the Eastern Mediterranean. However, I fully agree with Christos and Lazaros that we should be very disciplined in this in the approach of how we approach M&A. As Eurobank, I think we were very careful in the past. We have disinvested Serbian, a business that was producing an ROE below the group ROE at one times book, and we have invested in Cyprus, in Hellenic Bank, with a blended acquisition cost of more or less 0.5 times. I think this is the paradigm that we should follow going forward. It's not easy because the M&A market becomes more and more expensive, but we are monitoring it, and in case something makes economic sense, we are there. Lastly, shareholders' reward. We kick off this dividend affair with quote-unquote dividend affair with the buyback of HFSF shares last year, something that cost us close to 100 million euro. This year, we continued with a 30% dividend payout, or 342 million euro dividend, and our plan is gradually and slowly increasing our dividend payout ratio at 40% next year and 50% in 2026. Share buyback is something that we are also considering. Given that we trade close to book, it's something that has a marginal value. But anyway, it is something that it is within our radar.
Excellent. Thank you very much all for your answers. As this wraps our discussion today, I would like to thank Capital Link for organizing this webinar, our speakers, of course, and all our participants who joined us today. Olga, over to you for any closing remarks.
Okay. I would like to thank you all, Eleni, Christo, Harry, Lazaro, Theodore, for a very informative and insightful discussion. Thank you to all our participants for joining. And as a reminder, the webinar will be available for replay upon demand shortly. So thank you to all and goodbye.
Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good afternoon.